Okay, good morning, and welcome to May's ISB board meeting. We start with an educational session on dynamic risk management. I give the floor to Ross.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Before we begin the review of the material I sent out, I'd like to highlight that this session begins the conversation of what is the business of dynamic risk management that we laid out in our proposed project plan a couple of months ago. The approach to the project remains that we will discuss the business activity, demonstrate how that activity is currently reflected in the financial reporting, discuss the quality of that information, and then compare potential information of a new model with the information we currently have to evaluate whether statements along the lines of better or worse can be made. So we're focused on the first part right now. And so it's important to understand the business activity if we're to follow that path we agreed to. So today, starting the review of the business activity, we're going to discuss what DRM is trying to accomplish, why deposits are different than term funding in nature and why they pose a problem, and then how certain derivative transactions are executed and why those are executed. We'll discuss how those transactions are currently reflected in the financial statements at a later date. Our objective today is really to understand how those transactions are executed, why those transactions are executed, and how their cash flows will be realized. Please feel free to ask questions throughout the presentation. If a question will be answered later on in the presentation, then I apologize in advance for deferring my answer. So I will begin on slide 5. Banks often describe the objective of dynamic risk management as net interest margin stabilization. However, the term stable often takes on multiple interpretations. The following pages we will discuss the above. But as a starting point, I'm going to assume the objective of DRM is to minimize net interest margin fluctuations period over period. There are other potential objectives, and those will be addressed later in the presentation. When we're focusing on NIM, we'll help explain why there are multiple interpretations to that objective. Turn to slide 6. If I define net interest margin numerically, it would be yield on loans less the cost of funding. I'm going to focus on cost of funding. I'll break that down into two components, where I have cost of term funding, interest-bearing contractual debt, be it senior debt, covered bonds, other forms of issued notes. The holder of that debt has limited ability to ask for their funds to be returned to them. The second type of funding are deposits, funds placed with the bank for safekeeping. Generally speaking, those funds must be returned to the depositor within a short period of time if requested. So I can expand my equation to say that NIM is really equal to yield on loans, less cost of term funding, less cost of deposits. We're going to focus on deposits for the rest of the presentation. If funding was 100% term in nature, then the DRM problem is simpler to understand. If you want to stabilize NIM period over period, you would have your loans reprice at the same time you'd have your liabilities reprice, take advantage of shared pricing components, and then NIM would be stabilized period over period within some reasonable bound. However, deposits, obviously preferable from a profitability perspective, create a problem when thinking about how NIM will change period over period. Turn to slide 7 to start discussing that problem. If I focus on my equation and focus on the concept of product maturity, I want to highlight two comments. Loans, the vast majority of loans have a contractual maturity date after which they mature and they will be repriced assuming a commercial operation. Loans are priced at the time of origination, and therefore, as loans mature and reprice, the yield on those loans will change. Deposits, or a significant amount of deposits, are non-interest-bearing in nature and will likely never be interest-bearing. This means that the cost of that funding is effectively zero and is effectively perpetual. Main point here being that you have the vast majority of assets which will reprice, and significant amount of funding which will not reprice. Let's turn to slide 8. So if NIM is equal to yield less cost of funding, but significant portions of that funding are deposits, and those deposits are not interest bearing, then net interest margin is really yield on loans minus nothing. And so I can remove the nothing from the equation. And so the yield on the loans is really equal to the net interest margin if you have 100% deposit funded portfolio. Therefore, NIM for a deposit funded portfolio is dominated by asset yields. On slide 9, I'm going to try and combine these two points. So if NIM for deposit-funded portfolios is dominated by asset yields, and those assets must reprice, or they must mature and therefore they must reprice, this means that NIM must reprice. This implies that if you have a deposit-funded portfolio, net interest margin cannot be perfectly stable period over period into perpetuity. Therefore, it must change. And so my question at the bottom of the page there, if I'm to think about if my objective is to stabilize net interest margin, but it must change period over period, what does that term stable mean? So this really does imply that you can't eliminate repricing of the book. And the more deposits you have, the more true that becomes. So stabilization becomes much more about managing how NIM will reprice over time and understanding that and having a conversation around that. I'm going to jump to slide 36 because
I think. Mary, did you want to ask a question?
Russ, I did, and it's about credit because both the previous slide when you said basically if you've got deposits that are zero interest rate, and this slide that makes the point that loan pricing is a function of interest rates, raises the question for me about how, if at all, does credit and management of credit get brought in? Is that kind of just always in a separate department and considered separately so that when you're talking about interest rates, it's always assuming 100% collection of the asset returns? Just how does credit get either put in to this management or pulled out?
So I don't think there's one model on how the credit is managed. I'd say that it is very common for credit to be effectively pulled out of this evaluation to say there is a credit department that is responsible to manage the credit risk and the business model should be taking an appropriate amount of credit risk for your objective. And so I think a common model would be to say that, making up numbers here, if you have $100 loan pool, you might say, well, effectively 1% of that must be provided for credit. So you really have a $99 loan pool where you're going to be managing interest rate risk. To oversimplify it greatly, but that's effectively that's a common approach.
Because also as we start to pull out generalizations, and I think they're very helpful in terms of it's sometimes simplified conclusions that just are kind of markers to help us focus in on the issue. When I look at something like loan pricing as a function of interest rates, I think it's also must be a function of whether the lending institution decides to remain at the same place in terms of the credit profile of its portfolio, or whether it's decided to reduce the risk it takes or increase the risk it takes. So you could have, via this repricing, somebody deciding to incur a riskier portfolio and therefore starting to get different spreads, even though the overall interest rate environment might not change. So, and that's what made me think about where does credit come into this?
Yeah, you can have business migration,
yeah.
Even from people
okay.
Focus on different types of loans. It can happen, but
okay.
That's a fair point. We're focused here more on kind of base interest rate risk than credit spreads.
Okay.
Highlight point on slide 36. Just jump to the very back.
Okay. What happened?
It's a picture. I like pictures. But it shows the point in case study two, which I don't plan to go through. But it does show the point that if you have a deposit funded portfolio over the long run, you can have, if you have just 5-year loans or 2.5-year loans, which the example assumes, you have these spikes in repricing. And so when people talk about managing NIM in the DRM book and where deposits focus, you have these types of charts where they say, okay, this is my expected repricing profile, and am I comfortable with that? And what do I think, how should I be thinking about it in terms of my operation? So graphically, I quite like this chart, which is why I've just highlighted there, because it brings home the point about NIM repricing. It's not something you can, if you have a lot of deposits, you kind of have to manage it. It's not something you can eliminate. Okay. The point, jumping back to slide 9 now, The point that's heavily implied here, but not outwardly stated, is that if you want to change this profile on page 36, that the only cash flow generation that's happening is coming from the assets. The deposits are zero. We're assuming they're non-interest bearing, assuming they're perpetual, so they don't generate cash flows. And so if I want to change my net interest margin and change my cash flow profile, I'm really changing an asset profile, and I'm managing how those assets are going to be repricing. So I think talking about it in that context is helpful because it focuses on the cash flows and how those cash flows are going to be realized. I'll just pause there for a moment. I'm going to reinforce some of these concepts now in case study number one, which starts on page 13. This case study is going to illustrate a couple of things. It'll reinforce this concept of NIM repricing. It'll start to demonstrate how derivatives are used to transform portfolios. I'll go through this kind of step by step and slowly, but again, if there are questions, please stop me. And I'm more than happy to go through it a second time. So starting on page 13, AB Bank has a simple balance sheet of 1,000 currency units of fixed rate loans funded by core deposits. The chart below demonstrates the NIM profile over 10 years after management has completed their assessment that those deposits are effectively zero cost perpetual in nature. This implies the deposits in this purple box will be around for 10 years, and you can see that my green loan box is only around for 5 years, and so my dotted red box here is saying, well, I don't know what NIM is going to be after period 5, and so NIM is 100% subject to repricing risk at that time. So on slide 14, management has made a statement. They say, I'm uncomfortable with that repricing profile, and so they've chosen to have 40% of their book reprice after 5 years, but then 60% of it will reprice after 10 years. It's the decision they made. This chart below now starts to demonstrate how management will think about their portfolio in comparing the assets that they have to the asset profile that's just stated. So at the top asset profile, I have just 5-year loans. That's all I have right now. Compared to below, I can see that I want to have some 5-year loans, some 10-year loans. So highlight the point that I do not have these 10-year loans currently. And so some actions have to be taken today to solve that problem, and we'll step forward. Some actions will need to be taken at the end of year 5 to solve this problem. I will now walk through step by step how that will happen.
This for everyone in the class can still follow it.
But it's really good to break it down this way.
Yeah. Even I understand.
Go faster.
So the first step to do is to really to take your assets and to split them. And I'm going to split them into two pools here. I'll split them into a $400 pool and a $600 pool. This helps my comparison because I want to have, in this case, 400 to 5-year assets, and I have 400 to 5-year assets. And so no actions are required with that portion of the portfolio. I've achieved my objective. This chart should show you, though, that I want, again, reinforcing the point, that I want 600 or 10-year loans, and I don't have it. I only have 5 years. So I'm going to focus my attention on the 600 to now try and think about how to transform that loan portfolio. So step two on slide 16, first thing I will do is I will secure a 10-year asset. How I will do that is I will execute a 10-year receive fixed interest rate swap. The fixed leg of that instrument is going to yield a fixed amount for 10 years and provides the cash flow profile that I want over a 10-year period. So I have my 10-year asset now. However, the profile is not finished because I still have two other items. I have the original 5-year loan left, and now I have on the other side of the derivative I've executed this floating leg. So I have two instruments that I don't really want in this profile. 5-year fixed rate loan and this floating rate leg of the derivative. So what do I do about that? On slide 17, I can close out the position. I can do that with a 5-year pay fixed interest rate swap. So now I get more instruments now, so it's a bit kind of convoluted, but this red box is helpful here that I have fixed cash inflows coming from the loan for 5 years. Fixed cash outflows on the swap for 5 years. I have floating cash inflows from one swap, and floating cash outflows from another swap. There is no repricing risk in any of those instruments. They will reprice at the same time, regardless of what happens to the environments, as long as they continue to exist. So this is kind of my A call-out box here, saying I can really net this down to a notional of zero if I wanted to. We're not talking about presentations. We're not discussing that. But the combination of those four instruments yields 1% on a notional of 600, but there really is no net notional. Now, I also say, okay, I want a 10-year asset. I have my 10-year asset on the receive fixed swap on that leg. And so I have achieved my profile. I've transformed a 5-year loan into a 10-year loan. It doesn't really matter, but NIM in this example has changed from 6.5% to 11 based upon the actions that I've taken.
Well, but you've only transformed in terms of the interest rate, not the
yes.
principal.
Correct. Justin. Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely.
And Russ, maybe along the lines of Gary's question, when I look at the bottom of 16, and I think I'm quibbling about vocabulary, but it may or may not matter later on, so I want to get it straight. You say management is now funding a 5-year asset with floating rate debt. To me, with an interest rate swap as a derivative, presumably, because it has a notional principal, but not an actual principal, I look at it and say, no, the debt is still being funded by the deposits because that's the source of the cash. It's that the combined effect of the of the derivative means that there's this net exposure. And so I was quarreling with the use of, or the characterization of it as being funded by the swap, because it starts combining notional principles with actual, inflows and outflows of gross amount of cash.
Yeah, the point is, I think you and Gary are making the exact same point,
yeah.
And so I think it's a valid one. It can sometimes be, again, in simplifying and trying to generalize sometimes, it can be helpful to think about a derivative as two loans sometimes when talking about changing repricing. And so if you think of it from that perspective, then that's where this kind of funding comment comes from. But to your point, the derivative is not providing any cash. It's not notionally funding anything.
Yeah.
It's only on the interest. That's coming
in.
No
interest.
It's not a debt.
So I think, as we work through and build things up both in the education, even if, from a management perspective, it might be looked at as funding it, I think we should try and use funding only when it's actually the source of funding, because there may be times when that matters. I'm not sure if there will be, but there may be times when it matters.
But to be precise.
Well, this all assumes the interest rate market is fully and freely available.
It does assume the direct
that's
market.
That's what it does, and having lived through a loss of investment grade once in my career, I can assure you they are not always freely and fairly priced available to you. And therefore, it's not really quite as funded as you think on occasion. So just I think mayors are just be careful on labeling what's notional versus principal or whatever.
Yeah, and the liquidity in different markets will vary by jurisdiction as well. So it's not even a change in market environments in specific markets. Certain markets aren't as developed as others. That's fair. Someone might, just jumping ahead to slide 18 here, someone might comment saying, well, this is all fine. I'm following you up until the end of year five, because at the end of year five, three things are going to happen. So how are you contemplating those? The three things that will happen at the end of year five is that I'm going to receive 600 of cash because the original loan will mature. My original pay fixed swap will also mature. That was for 5 years. And presumably because I'm a commercial operation, I will fund another loan. So I will redeploy the $600 of cash into an operation. So after these events, if I assume, just for simplicity, that I fund another floating rate loan, the profile looks below. And so while I've lost the loan and I've lost the pay fixed swap and I've lost the float leg of the derivative, if I fund a floating rate loan, then I have a floating cash inflow. And so that float cash inflow nicely offsets the float cash outflow from the derivative I executed 5 years ago. And so while these events have to be thought about, they actually do not cause a problem for managing NIM over the 10 years. NIM is still maintained until the end of T10 in this example. Slides 19 and 20, which I won't go through in any detail, someone might say, well, I'm assuming a floating rate loan and that's convenient. That makes the example, but that might be a fixed rate loan that might fund. Slides 19 and 20 just comment that if a fixed rate loan will fund, then I really just start to repeat the original scenario where I need to have another derivative to deal with the fixed tenor of that new loan that comes on. The point there really is to say is that management can react. So management will have to recognize these events will occur, but management has the flexibility to react, to manage them, to maintain that profile. Something they have to be thought about, but they do not create an insurmountable challenge. Gary's point, the derivative markets must be open.
With this one, that's great.
I'll pause there. I'm happy to go through that case study again, but I think people are following how the NIM profile, cash flow profiles are pushed out. They're compared against the profile. Derivatives are executed to transform that profile. While certain cash actions must be assumed in the future regarding reinvestments of loans and maturities of products, that is all very manageable to maintain them.
Just a simple question, but on the average, the use of these derivatives, how much of the interest margin does that eat up in terms of costs?
In terms of,
it cannot be for free.
So I'll maybe try and answer your word about cost very specifically, because there is a cost to executing a derivative, but that is generally just a transaction cost of executing. And so there's a fixed amount of infrastructure that's required for people and collateral processing and the ability to confirm trades, and et cetera. So that's an operational cost, which is just a fixed amount to have a derivative shop. The physical cost of a derivative is likely less than a tenth of a basis point in terms of bid offer spread, which is kind of the accepted cost element of a derivative transaction.
And liquid markets.
And also, just one thing, Carl, a very relevant question. Here we are dealing with swaps. As soon as we start getting into another type of hedging instrument options, that cost shoots up. That's when it really becomes expensive, because you're buying insurance against one rate. So you will get the upside. So with swaps, because of the liquidity of the markets and everything, the cost is minuscule. But as soon as you go into options, which we'll cover, when you come to prepayments, the cost becomes quite high. That's when it becomes expensive.
On
Chang-Wu, this case study is very illustrative and explains everything here. So my question is, we started with a kind of objective of multiple interpretations of stability. So based on this conclusion of case one, what is the answer of this multiple interpretations of stability?
So the driving force behind all of the derivatives that were executed was this decision that management made that they want effectively 60% to reprice after 10 years. That doesn't have to be management's decision. They could have chosen something else. They could have chosen 1 year, could have chosen 2 years, and so on and so forth. And so the decision that they make implies something for their profile. And so the decisions around that profile are where the interpretations around the objective come in.
Okay, I see. In a sense, a company, a bank, can set a specific objective of NIM as they wish. Is it right?
They can set an objective for how NIM will reprice.
Yes.
Yes.
Reprice, but there are some banks would like to maybe have a more a riskier.
Yes.
So they would like to have a kind of a variable NIM rather than fixed NIM here like this. So I'm saying different strategies for different banks. That's the one thing. So another thing is that this case study is just we are focusing on one
strategy,
one asset or one and liability. We are not talking about dynamics of open portfolios. So that's the other issue. But you are saying at the next step, there will not be any change of our conclusion in case one, even though we expand this setting into open dynamic setting. So, I just wondering whether Yeah, we are going to talk about the accounting issue at the next stage. But at the first stage, the economics of the DRM looks like quite similar to the general operation of banks. So, what are differences between this DRM and the general operations of the banks?
I think one point which you make, coming to your first point, Changu, is that how does the stability come about? It's a very good point. We will build it up as we go through. As Ross pointed out, it is all embedded in what is the target asset profile and the strategy you're looking at. And as you rightly said, some management might want to keep it more open, and therefore we would call there would be taking a chance on the NIM going up or down rather than, and that's where it links up. But it's absolutely a good point. We can work on that. That's where the different interpretations of what we mean by NIM being stable comes in. We'll incorporate that into the cases as we go forward. And we will come to dynamic and how that changes. I don't think it changes the objectives that much. What it brings in, and we will also illustrate that with cases, is how, as Ross said, the management reacts. So if you, let's say, for example, end of T5, you don't get a floating, I think, and you get a fixed, then that becomes dynamic. You have to do another derivative to target or keep within your target asset profile. Regarding the objectives of what this is with the bank's operations, I think, and I'll let Ross come to that, but that I think this is a fundamental part of bank's operations. That's what they do.
The dynamic risk management, typically there's lots of different ways the departments are structured, but they're not typically responsible to originate loans or originate deposits. That's a business area that would do that. The dynamic risk managers are focused on managing the interest rate and the repricing of that interest rate. So, but it is a core operation to a banking book type bank. So, if the main objective is, if that institution is to raise funds through deposit taking and lend it out through retail lending, dynamic risk management or that department will be a core operation to that institution.
In the long run, it doesn't change earnings. It just smooths earnings.
Well, you are altering the actual cash inflows to an institution.
Yeah, but over time.
It changes
the real economics.
You've changed the amount of interest you're going to earn overall. Yeah?
You've changed
from fixed to floating interest, for example, which is that's an actual change.
That's an actual change.
So in this case, you'll see the NIM shoots up, but even if I take the case to maturity, because I've done it, that's highly exaggerated here from 6.5 to 11, just to show. But you can change the actual cash coming in through doing the swaps. That's what you're doing.
If you have done nothing after 5 years, if the interest rate has decreased, let's assume to 1%, then in the years 5 to 6 to 10, you have only, then let's assume you can make a loan only for 1%, you have only a NIM for 1%. But now you have, make sure, okay, that you have at least under this 10-year management horizon, you have a kind of stable NIM, which is 11%. Yeah. So it changes really the kinds of earnings of this bank.
Because it's going to change because it depends on how well your appetite for repricing matches up to where there are changes in interest rates that you can take advantage of. So, if you kept the 5-year profile and interest rates shot up, you'd be in a better position to take advantage of it. So your selection of repricing will actually affect the total net income because it depends on where you are in the interest rate cycle.
And you've really changed your risk as well because that strategy could be sort of a positive or a negative outcome depending on where rates move.
Exactly. Absolutely. Coming to the last thing, which Ross also loves, and I love this slide number 36. If you look at the curve, maybe that's exactly what you're talking about. That's what we would call the ladder, and those are the open positions. And depending upon your view on rates, that's how you will either lock it in or keep it open, depending upon what point you go.
Gary?
Ross, just an operational question. Everything else being sort of equal and available, would interest rate swaps be the first go-to tool to do this? Because as opposed to the central bank windows or buying time deposits.
Yes.
This would be the preferred vehicle.
Yes. Thank you.
Stephen?
Information about the repricing of NIM is obviously very important to investors, and you mentioned slide 36 and the ladder. How much of this is visible to investors at the moment, either through IFRS disclosures, regulatory disclosures, or just practice?
The short answer is relatively little. There might be some information you can take from the MD&A about what your limit structure is. Most operations will have a limit structure around short-term NII sensitivities. So some of that is disclosed, but that's not a lot of information. There are some disclosures that are made in some institutions where they'll show the contractual maturity of loans by time bucket. And so that's a tabular disclosure, so we'll have 3 months, less than 6 months, and so forth. People have made those disclosures. Why? So they'll say, I'll have a loan repricing between 1 to 10 years, and that does not provide a lot of useful information. So I would say it's relatively little. It's not nothing, but certainly not this chart on page 36 that's being disclosed.
I think this is a major frustration for investors. So this project is going to resolve the measurement mismatch and derivatives, fair value, loans, deposits, costs, so that's all fine. To what extent is the focus of this project to rectify the information deficiency about future net interest margin?
Well, so I think we laid out in our project plan that one of our main principles, objectives, whatever word we called it, was to think about what should be the information content of financial statements and what information should we be giving to users about what's happening in the operation. And so, I'm not sure that we're committing to anything right now, but I think that's certainly a reasonable question as to what disclosure should be made about how quickly or how slowly will the book reprice.
One of the things, and this is going back from the last outreach and other things which came up, was this is what banks would call structural hedging programs, what they're doing, changing the structure of their book. And certainly one of the investors' requirements is, let's say, we are in now in a low interest rate environment, and if banks have a huge book of mortgages which will reprice now, investors don't know whether the banks will be in that repricing bucket where they will have to originate new loans at this environment, low interest rate, which will start squeezing their NIM, or whether they have already locked it in. So what investors are looking for is not exactly the bucket, but indicators which will help them understand how stable or unstable the NIM is going to be going forward and where these open things are, open positions are, as we call them. So yes, I think going forward, Steve, one of the critical elements of this will be is how do we communicate this to investors, what they're looking for in the structural hedging. Absolutely.
Great, Warren.
Follow the question from Steve. Mm-hmm. I recall the questions from our about measurement PIR, and one of the concern from even the investors is, you know, there are so many up and down, and you disclose highly difficult to categorize so clearly. So as a result, it's actually mixed pictures. And my question to Kuma, you just said you will discuss the possible, you know, changes in the future, and in what, you know, format, mainly through the disclosure, the note disclosure to the financial statements, or more mandatory commentary type of, no, just a foresee, you know, rather than actual.
We aren't there, but certainly what, one of the things when we're doing the outreach and also is that a couple of banks, and I think I would be saying one bank, actually did a very good disclosure, not because of any other requirements, but because of investor pressure on what could be the potential, what they call the structuring hedging program, how much of their NIM of their book is open to repricing, they gave that. So we will consider those. I don't think it'll be purely MD&A management kind of commentary. It has to be with some actual quantitative disclosure as well. It cannot be purely one.
Okay, Cindy.
Kumar, I may be refining too much on a remark you made before in response to Steve, which was about investor needs, and you're saying they're not looking for buckets, but they want some indication of repricing risk. Is it really true that we know that they are not looking for explicit disclosure of the repricing, or that having assumed that they can't, that they would never be given that information, they are looking even for a proxy that gives them some information about that exposure?
Thank you, Merrick. I think what we heard was that how we get that information, it could be through buckets or it could be some other way, is not very critical. What we are after is understanding how much of that NIM is going to reprice when, and how much of that have you locked in through your structural hedging program. So to be fair, absolutely, it could be through bucketed information which is there, could be through some other way, but their objective is towards that, so looking at how stable the NIM profile will be.
Okay, because I mean, it's not that I'm suddenly an advocate of we must get to the buckets, but it seemed that you'd reached a conclusion that they didn't want that, as opposed to
no. What they were after is the objective. How we get there is up to us. They weren't drilling down into that level of detail.
Yeah, based on that question, then, are you looking for a general improvement of disclosure of NIM? Because if that is true, man, even a bank, if they don't use derivatives in this scenario, then have a repricing risk. And my understanding is not in this project that we give then a kind of discussing overall disclosure of interest rate risk. Because my understanding is if we still looking at kind of dynamic risk management when we're using derivatives and how to account for these derivatives, and then maybe if you're doing that, what is a disclosure? So I think in an early point of this project, we have to be more or less clear what we want to do, because otherwise we're discussing, or in this example, if a bank not using any derivatives, what is their open risk position for interest rate risk, and do we want to have specific disclosure for that, or do we concentrate on kind of, I would say, hedge accounting? So if they're using derivatives and in this dynamic risk management, if they want to achieve a specific NIM, what is then the recognition and measurement for this derivatives with additional disclosure? But I think that we have
to decide
at some point in time, and otherwise we're discussing an even bigger project.
I think Martin's question is a fair one, and I think it might be a little bit early to know conclusively what the answer to that is. I sort of appreciate your comment in terms of scope, and I think it's something we need to think about, but I think in an ideal world what we want to try and do is come up with an approach which makes preparers more comfortable. They can better depict their activity, because I think their concern at the moment that this accounting mismatch between the way derivatives are measured and things are measured at amortized cost doesn't really result in a particularly helpful way for them to communicate or for investors to understand. So I think that's one aspect of it, but I also think it's a good opportunity for us to, in addition to thinking about that mismatch sort of point, which is more of a hedge accounting perspective, to also think more a little bit more broadly about what's useful information for users of financial statements, which hopefully helps preparers communicate and users understand. And I think maybe we need to have a little bit of an open mind in terms of what the scope is, because one of the criticisms that we got in response to the first discussion paper was the fact that if you did any hedging activity, suddenly all the focus was on you and your mismatches, etc., whereas if you were completely, you know, just didn't worry about it and just let things go and saw what happens, then you sort of were off scot-free and everything was at cost and it looked great, but actually you were in a more risky position. So I think if we think a little bit more broadly about disclosures, it's a way to level the playing field a little bit as well and take this tension off the, because I've been the good guy, I end up looking like the risky person. And so maybe that's what we need to think about. But I think because the next step is probably a discussion paper, gives us a little bit more opportunity to explore a little more what the disclosures might look like as well and their scope.
Can I answer to that? I agree with you, but I think the risk is that we then have the scope too broad, and I think that was also kind of problem in the first DP which we had, because then a lot of, I think, comments which we get back is, okay, if you're doing that and if you're doing nothing, then it was okay of getting more volatility, and even worse than the situation was without this kind of this project, and therefore it is a little bit, I agree with fully what you said, but it is a kind of question which we should carefully think about, because otherwise, even if we maybe come up with good things for a bank who is managing with derivatives and this interest rate risk, but if we make it too broad and we get negative feedback from others, which then also from regulators, we had also, I think, kind of comments that we say don't want to have this open transparency for many banks. I think that was what I at least have seen from the first discussion paper, and that is a little bit difficult to judge them.
I agree with you, and I think it's a very good challenge, but I do think that part of the reaction we got to the original discussion paper was because all of those mismatches were being elevated to recognition and measurement and creating volatility. So I think we need to keep that in mind as well.
It's true that criticism arose at the time, but one price that was made was about the attempt at giving insight into the income outcome, if I may call it that way, dividing it into how the net income reacted to the market and how the hedging activities changed that. And that was widely priced. So this is not something that you obtain only through disclosures, would be my first note. And I think, in my view, it should remain an objective of this project. Now, moving to disclosures, and in fact, I was this was triggered by Steve's comment. I think we certainly should be getting insight into what would be useful to investors. I mean, that's what's driving our work. But we, I would make two comments. First of all, I think we have, at this stage, extensive disclosure requirements in IFRS 7. So maybe we should try to see why disclosures are so ineffective, if they are indeed ineffective, with what we have already in practice. And I would also refer to our disclosure initiative and the principles for disclosures that we have set, or at least proposed at this stage, and that for financial statements, very much focus on what to expand on what is recognized. And here we are, I think, very much in the area of management strategies. So the question is, certainly users would need some information, but I think some part of that information is not necessarily part of financial statements.
Fair point, Vasil. Regarding IFRS 7 also, we will certainly consider not only what has been given, but what under new 9 will come into play, certainly, and the board. Fair.
Okay, Russ, continue.
Okay. I had my big conclusion ready that everyone's following, so I'll skip ahead. we've talked a lot about management strategies, target profiles, so this is a bit of a step away from demand deposit modeling as a term. And so what I want to talk a little bit about is that the distinction that we're drawing between asset profile management, management strategy, demand deposit modeling is potentially a distinction without a difference. So I'll jump to slide 21 to try and take you through the demonstration of this. This is just a case study where, rather than comparing an asset profile against this target profile, I'm going to compare it against a model deposit. So the profile starts the same, and the decision that is made is similar from management's perspective, that they model a liability 40% for 5 years and then 60% for 10 years. If I turn to slide 22, you should start to see some similarities, that I have an asset profile and a liability profile. The liability profile has this 5-year portion and a 10-year portion. If I'm a risk manager and I look at this comparison, I start to draw the same conclusions that I made earlier, that I've got 400 of fixed rate assets, 400 of fixed rate funding, no action required. That's what I have matched assets and liabilities, and then I have 600 of 5-year assets and 600 of 10-year liabilities. I'm not matched. So I'm going to do the immediate same drill down, and focus in on the 600 where the three pricing risk is in existence. These are the same observations that I made on slide 15. So I think you'll start to hopefully follow the story on slide 23. I would execute the same trade. So I would have a 10-year receive fixed swap and a 5-year pay fixed swap, the receive fixed providing my necessary duration and the pay fixed swap shedding the excess 5-year. This chart on slide 23 is identical to the one we looked at on the earlier slide, and the NIM profile resulting is the exact same. So from this perspective, like demand deposit modeling is really just a mirror of the target asset profile. Slide 24, it's a comparison. The ending cash, the instruments they're providing cash are the exact same. So it becomes an operational question as to how you want to do this. I can compare the assets I have against this target profile, and that target profile is informed by the amount of core deposits that I have. Or I could compare the assets I have against the deposits I have, which are informed by a profile that I set upon them. That's really a distinction without a difference. The main focus, I would argue, is that we have cash flows being provided by assets and loans, and how, since in this example we've constructed, that's the only cash inflow, that should be the intent of the focus, and that's the information that we're trying to talk about. Slide 11 is another conclusion that really demand deposit modeling is a means to an end. It's not the end in itself. It's to facilitate management in assessing the assets that it has against this profile that it's decided is appropriate. From that perspective, it's, if you say I'm hedging a demand deposit or I'm transforming an asset profile, I'm making a distinction without a difference.
Yeah, Ross, I felt like I, you know, was grasping the basics, and I kind of fell off when we got to this. I get the mechanics, and I see that the mechanics are the inverse. It's not a question of mechanics. But I see two kinds of liability modeling, and I'm not yet accepting of the it's a distinction without a difference conclusion. Because A, I see the modeling that you have to do that says, I have X amount of deposits. What portion of them are sufficiently sticky that I should regard them as core, as in essence perpetual? So I can see why you have to do modeling of liabilities to come up with that conclusion. And in this, you know, in the examples that we've been working with, it's the 1,000 that we've said is the core. And so I get liability modeling for that purpose. In example 1A, when you say, at the bottom of slide 21, for example, liability profile equal to 60% 10-year funding and 40% 5-year funding is modeled. I don't think that's, again, this may be vocabulary, but to me, that sentence doesn't convince me, because we've already concluded that the 1,000 is, in effect, perpetual. And I think what you're saying is management decides from a target profile of NIM that they want, you know, 60% to have a 10-year profile and 40% to reprice after 5 years. But that isn't actually modeling the liabilities to try and say what do we expect to happen based on deposit givers. It's saying here's what we desire in terms of the profile of our income. And to me, the fact that you can express it by saying it's target liability is actually confusing rather than helpful, because in the example you've given, it's all about the yield on the assets rather than on the liability. And it's actually not 10-year funding or 5-year funding, it's perpetual funding, unless what you're actually saying is we've modeled the deposits and concluded that a sufficient portion is going to be core for only 5 years, and another portion is going to be core for 10 years. But at the end of that period, we expect these to have been withdrawn, and therefore, in effect, the liability paid. I get that the mechanics work in the inverse. I see that you could express it this way, but I don't accept that we should start talking about hedging deposit liabilities when in the economics you've laid out, all the exposure is coming from the assets, and there's no volatility coming from the deposits.
So I think I gravitate immediately to the last thing you said there, is that it can be expressed this way.
Yeah.
So it's, I think this is hopefully to provide a bridge as to how it's been addressed sometimes historically, to your point, which I agree, that if you're really focusing on NIM and cash flows, that talking about an asset profile is simpler and easier to understand. So it's to help people with that bridge, if you want to bridge from kind of a deposit conversation to this asset profile conversation we're having.
But it's not only that it's simpler, easier to understand from an asset, you know, if you express it as asset, that's where the actual exposure seems to be. In this case, you know, agree with the assumption that deposits have zero interest rates attached with them, so they are, in essence, free funding. All the exposure is the assets. For one reason or another, you may wish to express it as a liability, but that's a proxy for what the actual exposure is. And it does become confusing when you're talking about modeling in two different planes. One is, what's the modeling of my deposit base to identify the core portion, or how the deposit base will behave? And the other is to say, I'm going to take my asset exposure and express it as a liability exposure. And it's that second one that sends my head spinning a bit.
No, I think your first articulation was the much better way of putting it. You do have to, the level of modeling, which is of demand deposit, is the core element. The rest is a proxy for the asset profile.
Right.
It's much easier to express it. We will do it that way going forward, Mary.
I mean, if we have to be aware that people very often speak of it this way, I think that's something to be aware of. But I hesitate that we start expressing ourselves in that same way if that's not what the exposure is.
Yeah. I think the critical point, as you rightly pointed out, and Ross also said, is the key point is, although people talk about hedging a demand deposit profile, they're actually managing their asset profile. That's the point we are trying to make. And as you rightly pointed out, the articulation you said you provided is a better way of explaining that.
Peter.
I'd like to pursue Mary's point and then work up towards a question. I found this very interesting, and it opened up a new way of thinking for me, because I think whenever we've had these discussions before, we've been stuck in the kind of liability modelling language and way of thinking about it. And what this said to me was that if we were just looking at the deposits, then actually we could forget about the liabilities, which would be very good, because those are all the things we've been tripping up over for the last 10 years or more, which is, are we focusing on existing liabilities? What's the fair value of the liability? How do we distinguish between the existing liability and future deposits and all those things? And if we're able to just look at the asset, then we can forget about all those things, which could be, I think, very helpful. But of course, looking at the things that are funded by fixed deposits, it's a different world, because there it does actually matter what the assets and liabilities are, and you're looking at what the actual interest rate gaps are on the existing assets and liabilities, and so there it's very important. So the question I'm working up towards is, if we were able to split it cleanly into sort of half a bank funded by fixed deposits and half funded by other types of deposits and look at them separately, that would be great. We can forget about the liabilities in one half and we consider them in the other. But I assume it's not as easy as that in the real world, and we probably have to look at them both together, which means we might not be able to forget about the liabilities even on the deposit side.
I don't want to jump to it, but yes, I think even if you have what you're calling fixed deposit, you mean term funding, where the liability has got an interest rate component. Yes, there it becomes a little bit more complex because it's an interaction, but it still comes within the same model. But yes, it won't be that simple. But one of the things, let's develop that, is that primarily it will still be driven by an asset profile, Peter. That's what you're doing, but it gets more complex.
It would solve a lot of problem in the banking system if we could completely forget about deposits now.
Take it out.
Stephen?
When people talk about behavioralizing core demand deposits, what do they mean? And I think they often are referring to the sort of notional thing you've done here, which is some of the core demand deposits are assumed to be for 5 years and others assumed to be for 10 years for the purpose of then achieving the desired profile for the net interest margin, which is not really anything to do with anybody's behavior, is it? It's a very odd term to use in this area.
Yeah, I agree.
So therefore, perhaps we should try and move away from this notion of behavioral. I know you haven't used it here, but it's something that we've been guilty of, I think, in the past.
I have always hated the term, too.
There is an element of, that's been referred to, you have to establish what is core and what is non-core. That's a different conversation.
Well, yeah. But the core and non-core is subject to uncertainty. So let's suppose this bank simply has 1,000 of deposits. Or if things work out as we expect and the bank expands and economic conditions are benign, the deposits will be at least 1,000 in the future. There is a risk that things happen and that the deposits turn out to be 500 and we have to go into the market to obtain other funding. Yes. What's the core in that case?
In that case, you just constructed 500.
Well, I would say it's 1,000 subject to risk. I mean, because the 500 is a possibility that it might happen. Maybe it's a 20% probability and 80% probability you will end up still with your 1,000. So I'm not sure you can identify the core and the non-core demand deposit in that way, because it's all subject to fluctuation and risk in the future.
So a couple of things. I appreciate the sensitivity around the word behaviorization, but I think it is a relevant word in this for exactly the conversation you've had. And I think there was a little thing that you slipped in right at the beginning of the presentation, which is the bank has analyzed its deposits and decided that 1,000 is core or whatever you want to call it. I suspect we would say in Stephen's example that if I expected that I had a certain portion that was core, and it turned out not to be the case, it is in part failure of my hedging of the DRM strategy here. And I'm going to see that as a failure coming through in however we choose to represent it, was the first thing. And then I thought, to Mary's point, I think that is something of, I don't want to use the word core, something of the substance of the discussion that Martin and Sue were having earlier, is that I think to an extent what we've done in the process that we've gone through here is we have determined that what we're trying to measure with DRM is the outcome of the strategy being pursued by the bank. That means the outcome of this specific strategy is the 600, because that's the part of the strategy that I'm looking to solve for. And if that's the case, I think you can express it either from a liability side or from an asset side if I'm focused on the 600. And then I think further to where Sue and Martin were going, the additional 400 becomes the potential disclosure practice that we would have in the background. But I would have said that you could express this from both angles because of the fact that we're only focusing on the bit where the strategy is being put in place.
So I'm going to ask you what may be an embarrassingly simplistic question, but I think it builds on Mary and Peter's questions, because in the history of this project, I've always got the impression that a lot of the issues coming up are because quite a lot of funding is in the form of this 0% funding, which sort of legally is overnight funding, but in reality is longer term funding. And it is this 0% stuff that people find complicated. And my understanding has always been that what people really wanted to be able to do to get this to work for them was to treat the core deposit as the hedged item. And when I look at these, and because this is such a simplistic example, but it looks like the thing you should want to hedge is the asset, but they want to hedge the deposit.
Yeah. I think
why?
Why?
Let's come to that, but I don't think simplistic or otherwise we would alter that, because what you're really doing is looking at the asset profile.
So why can't they just say, why do they say they run out of hedged items?
Because these, most of the asset profiles, when you're looking forward to, is in the future, would not meet most probably the highly probable test.
Because they're hedging future assets. Yeah. Okay.
It's a combination of things, not as simple as that.
As we said in the beginning, or someone mentioned next steps, we'll talk about prepayment risk as well.
Yes.
So that we have assumed for the starting conversation that there's no risk as asset disappears. That's not a risk for 100% of the book, or perhaps not even 50% of the book, but it is a risk for some of it, and it has to be considered.
But that's very helpful.
Ralph, can I just call out the point that just came out of the discussion with Sue is something that I think we have to capture and remind ourselves of and figure out how to deal with it, which is you've demonstrated the mechanics, you know, again, it's what I call an aha moment. You demonstrated the mechanics of asset liability, it doesn't matter, it works out the same thing, and Daryl was open to seeing, you know, it's the 600 that we're focusing on. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that the reason people want to express it as a liability is because the liability is going to be there for a really long time, while the asset is today's asset plus, you know, the T5 replacement plus the T10 replacement, and we start to get in, at least in our current hedging model, into questions about the probability of, you know, what's coming in at T5 and T10. And if you can suddenly magic them away by saying, let's look at it as if it were the liability that we were hedging when the liability doesn't give a risk, it eliminates what we have seen as a significant conceptual and mechanical barrier. And I don't want to just magic it away by saying, okay, because the mechanics work the same, you can look at the liability when the liability isn't the source of risk. But that may mean that we want to look at some of this differently. I'm not saying therefore it's dead, but I don't want to lose sight of that, because what it's showing is that in your graphs, for example, on 21, where you're showing the 6.5 for 5 years and then the reprice risk, you know, it's coming in at T5. We don't want to. You're saying this is the interest. This is the repricing profile risk, but it's also the question of what is it, is it a recognized asset or a future asset that is the source of the risk, and we're accounting for repricing risk, which is a future transaction risk, and let's not lose sight of that by saying, so we'll just focus on its mirror.
No, we won't. But that's why we are also looking at the other side, Mary. If you look at the mirror, all of that gets moved away if you do that. So yes, we will come to that.
But so coming on Mary's point, I mean, yes, a liability is going to be there for a long time, but I think we're into a set of arbitrary decisions about which liability we're talking about, whether it's a core liability, whether it's just existing liabilities, whether it's new deposits and all those things. On slide 21, management's taken a decision that they want to look forward 10 years on this piece of the liability they've identified, and that's, it's just a set of arbitrary decisions that it's 10 years and what piece of liability it is.
Well, that's scientific, not arbitrary.
Yeah, I mean, there's just as much uncertainty over the liability as there is the asset.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a reason to have the pointing at the asset, at the liability side, rather than the asset side. Isn't it all to do with OCI?
Again, we're trying to talk about the business activity rather than the implications of financial reporting, but we will have to talk about
cash flow versus fair value hedge, isn't it?
All right. Sorry. Didn't get your point.
We will have to consider, as a practical reality, the capital implications will have to be considered at some point, which is your question.
Martin?
I have a question. I don't understand why we discussing if it is an asset or a liability, because if the purpose is net interest margin hedging, my net interest margin is, okay, interest income from assets and interest expense from the liability, so it is a net position. And if we are discussing case studies in a more realistic example, then we include term deposits or really interest paying deposits. And then I think it is what we have to focus in is on the by time bucket, the open leg, which is then hedged by derivatives. So I think it is a kind of not so important now if it is from an asset or liability profile. I think only want to demonstrate is, okay, that this, if it is core demand deposits, we can say, okay, it comes from the asset side. Yeah. But I think in the final, in the real world, it does not matter. Because what you're doing is to really to hedge the open positions by time buckets. That is what is happening. And really, even if it kind of, let's assume a bank has in the 5 year buckets has term deposits which are higher than the term assets, and you have an overhang in the, and you do also kind of hedging. What matters is a repricing risk in this certain time periods, what you are doing. And I think that is a core message. It is not individual items. It is the repricing risk which happens, which includes then the core deposits. And I think that should be the message, that you could not exclude it. You have to include it. And I think that is what I have learned from this exercise. I think it is not about behavioralization. It is how a management is managing the repricing risk in certain buckets and including this term demand deposits. It is this core demand deposits.
Okay. I'll move on to the reconciliations.
The slides 25 through 28. To Martin's points, you're really focusing on NIM and repricing risk, and if you have a thorough understanding of what you want that to be, and you want to state a profile, and you want to manage that profile, you should understand the factors which could impact NIM, and you should understand, in theory, all of them. And so what you can do is to provide yourself a way to assess your own performance. You can focus on NIM and you can focus on cash. Again, and you can create reconciliations and say, what was I expecting NIM to be on the book versus what did NIM actually get reported in the financial statements? And so the case study number one, it only had three products that were providing cash flows. It had a loan, it had had the fixed legs of swaps, and it had the float legs of swaps. So what I've done as an oversimplified example on slides 26 is I have a data capture process that said I made a decision about NIM profile, and so I'm able to quantify what I expect NIM to be over this time horizon that I've set. I can now measure what NIM actually is against that profile. And so I understand what the actual NIM is going to be, or actual impact on the income statement will be from the loan, from the swaps, and from the fixed legs and float legs, assuming some type of accrual accounting on the swaps. And I can use that to compare and decide whether or not I achieve my objective or not. Slide 26 shows it all worked out, but where it's more interesting is on slide 27, where the received fixed swap, for whatever reason, was not executed at the exact right time. And so there was a change in rates between when I decided when I said I should have executed, quote unquote, to when I did. And so rather than securing 10% in the example, I got 9.95. And so my expected NIM and my actual NIM are different. This is a tool that can be used, A, to ground yourself in cash and what's real, but also provide some type of performance assessment backwards looking as to did you achieve the profile you wanted to. On slide 28, I kind of expanded saying, well, if I do this expectation at the product line level, if I do an expectation at the loan level and at the swap level, if there was a problem in any of those swaps, if there was the loans behave different than I expected, are they subject to payment risk, if the deposits behave differently, because they actually were interest-bearing and I was wrong, this information would all be provided. And it can start a management investigation to say what part of my risk measurement process is incorrect, and how do I fix that? So the reconciliations do exist in practice. These are overly simplified. But they provide a nice way to ground everyone back to this is about NIM, this is about cash flows. And there is a way to measure cash flows uncertainties. If you thought a loan was fixed, for example, but it turned out to be variable, and variable rates change, this report would catch that. And so it's a way to have a backward-looking performance assessment.
Mary?
Just mechanical, how do the economics work question, something that struck me on slide 26, but when I worked through kind of the offsets here, to me what was happening is the 10-year floating and the 5-year, the inflow-outflow, I can't remember which one was which. You were saying basically you have floating in, you have floating out, but one is a 5-year duration, one is a 10-year duration. This assumes that because they're both floating, they would pay the same float rate even though they have markedly different durations.
Which is entirely accurate.
Okay. Because it came to, it comes to can you have different durations as long as it's the same nature?
Yeah, they both
floating versus fixed offset. Okay.
Yeah, in this example, I've struck them against 1 month LIBOR in this example. So I have like 1 month LIBOR for 10 years or 1 month LIBOR for 5 years. It's still 1 month LIBOR. So.
Jung-woo,
thank you.
the meaning of this many reconciliation. On page 26, this is a normal perfect case. There is no error. On page 27, there was error. There is a delay in derivative execution and some change of the market condition. So this kind of analysis, I'm just curious about implications of these two reconciliations. What you are going to explain us about these reconciliations, what implications you are going to give us?
Oh, you mean what are the accounting implications in the...
not accounting implications. This is just showing the error made by the management. Is it correct? That's my understanding. Just error management.
So the idea of this reconciliations was that how does do you pick up? Because remember, we are all looking at a target profile.
Mm-hmm.
So which is, as you said, it's a management decision, which against it. How do you pick up and how is the control when what happens when there's a deviation from that profile? How do the banks in the economic sense capture it? That was the only thing which we were trying to do. So for example, in this case also, we haven't shown this here, if the demand deposit, which we assume to be core of 1,000, didn't end up being 1,000 and we had to go to the market and fund it with something else, this is the table where these things would be picked up. They will immediately start showing up whenever you have a movement from the profile. That's what we were trying to establish, generally.
It's budget versus actual.
Yes. So this kind of reconciliation is creating some kind of a excessive, maybe hope, desire from, for example, investors.
No.
And, maybe a kind of a additional disclosure.
Changu. We are just trying to show how this will be picked up, like Steve's point, and if there's a difference, how will it be picked up, or is it lost in the pile? It's not. There are controls where this gets picked up.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering whether many people worried about the scope of this project. So that's why I'm saying that maybe we are talking about some implication of this reconciliation, but
not
if
yet.
That's not the case, then
not yet. We are not even in any model as yet.
Patience.
Sorry.
Francois.
Well, when I looked at these reconciliations, I thought you had put them in to give us comfort about the robustness of the management strategies, but certainly not featuring future disclosures.
I'm not saying they won't feature in future disclosures or anything.
That was
it's basically, this is how what the controls are. Yeah.
Internal control.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Slide 29. So how is, perhaps we've talked about this a lot already, but how is this information relevant to the accounting model we're trying to develop? And so not only relevant just to understand the business activities and some of the governance that's around them, but when we talk, Stephen points earlier, about what information would be useful to users, the ISB already acknowledged that the solution to this problem will have to consider the needs of constituents. And so we should think about what proper disclosures are, what's recognition and measurement. But importantly, again, what should be the user focus here? So the first one here, what profile have you chosen and why did you choose it? Are you stabilizing or do you have an optimization focus? That's probably useful information for users to understand. Different banks will have a different answer to that question. And so given they can relate to different economics, potentially we should consider if that's useful information to users. How successful is management in achieving their target profile? Can they achieve it? This reconciliation kind of says management's set a target profile. How robust are they in evaluating core deposits? How sophisticated are they? How conservative or aggressive are they? Then specifically related to deposits, the presentation kind of glanced over, but we talked quite a lot about it. What's your process to evaluate core versus non-core? What factors are you considering? And potentially, in the vein of stress testing, how wrong could this be? How wrong could you have gotten this, and what are the implications of that? What's the downside? So, information to consider that users might be interested to know. So, page 30, we just go to our next steps where we effectively restate our project plan for the next time. So, we're still in what is the business of DRM. We've had a thorough discussion here, and I think people are following. We'll have to talk about prepayment risk and the dynamic nature of portfolios. These examples are overly simplified, but prepayment risk, there's an economic cost that has to be discussed, and dynamic is it won't invalidate anything, but we do need to understand how that moves. So our next steps are to discuss those two topics.
Doug. Thank you. Discussion about stabilization was really interesting, and actually from the management view, so it is very important because it's a target versus actual. So in a sense, this is sometimes something like a budgetary control. But then from the viewpoint of management, the accounting risk and real risk is in a sense similar, as long as budget control is concerned. So if it's wrong in the accounting sense, the outcome was wrong, even if you have hedged the economic risk. But if the accounting outcome was wrong, then from the viewpoint of budget control, you lost. So therefore, for the management perspective, there is no big differences between accounting risk and economic risk. That is reality. Then the point is difficult about the question on the page 29. What is the role of the accounting? That is the most important point when we discuss what is the next step. And I think as far as a time horizon is concerned, I think it's a very difficult time to develop some kind of a standard, especially when it comes to the recognition and the measurement, because concurrently we are having primary financial project and the conceptual framework, as well as FICE project. And also IFRS 9 in itself hasn't been implemented yet. So then we don't know what is the outcome of the IFRS 9. So then if the outcome of IFRS 9 is different, quite different from IAS 39, then the strategy of management, risk management, may differ. As I said, accounting risk and economic risk, in a sense, is similar for the management view. So therefore, when we discuss next step, we need to consider not only just this macro hedge project, but also we need to consider what is the outcome of other projects. And also, my preference is I think we should wait for PIR of IFRS 9, because we have to know what is the impact of IFRS 9 significantly. Of course, concurrently, we need to study like this. But when we kick into the recognition of the measurement, we need to know what's the outcome of IFRS 9.
This is Martin is getting excited.
I'm only to say that, Megan. IFRS 9, I think what we have done, we have said, okay, because we have not solved this problem, people can still have IAS 39 hedge accounting and especially portfolio. Now to say we have to wait until the post-implementation review for IFRS 9, which is not addressing this issue, to start this project, I think isn't not a good solution, because we especially in 9 said, okay, we don't have a solution, so you can keep 39, but now say, okay, we cannot address this issue because we have to wait until 9 is implemented, which is not addressing this issue, it's a little bit.
But we should get some nice new disclosure for those who apply, irrespective of
so I think we should do it now because we have not addressed it in 9. Okay.
So what is the risk that we finish this before the PIR of
IFRS? It's not very high.
I'm not touching their argument. Mine is a much simpler question. Back to slide 29 and the questions that you identified to follow up. And the third is, which factors are considered when determining core versus non-core? I just wanted to check that point three was about the modeling to determine what portion of your deposit liability is expected to remain, and it's only focused on.
How do you determine what the 1,000 is?
Okay, that's fine. I was just checking because the whole paper was premised on interchangeability of asset and liability perspective. So then agree, if it's specifically about that, how do we determine what the 1,000 is?
Stephen?
I agree with Martin, we shouldn't wait for the PIR to carry on with this project. However, Martin mentioned that 9 and 9 doesn't provide the solution to this. Obviously, 9 doesn't deal with these issues, but then 39 doesn't either. And the elimination of 39, which I think should happen, and it's crazy having two hedge accounting models out there, the elimination of 39 is not actually dependent upon the outcome of this project. It's just dependent upon the board getting rid of it. Because
it's never been linked. Yeah.
Everything under 39 is possible under 9 the way we've written it.
I think the only part Martin was specifically referring to is the macro fair value hedge accounting.
Which is different. And
which is different.
That's not the 39 hedge accounting model that we've perpetuated for no good reason, in my view.
You're right, technically speaking, but I think our messaging has been that 39 will stay until we have an outcome on this project.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Ross.
Thank you.
Very clear. Let's take a break.